Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on uniformitarianism when we come back. You know, in Job 38, verse 24, we read a scientific question. And the question is, by what way is it that the light is parted? Or if we paraphrased it, it would say, by what way or technique is the light apportioned or separated? Now imagine asking a question like that 4,000 years ago. Now, it is, of course, a simple question to answer today, and the student says, well, by passing it through the prism of the spectroscope. But who could have known that 4,000 years ago back in Job's day? Now, when we heat a metal red hot or heat any substance until it's incandescent, it gives forth rays of light. These rays of light, after passing through the prism of the spectroscope, divide themselves on the graph according to the content of the matter that sent them forth. So when a ray of light reaches us from some far-flung star, we need only to pass that light ray through the spectroscope to see the composition of that star and the proportion of each of its ingredients. This division of light rays is always constant. It doesn't vary in the least particular, so that we may always rely upon the results. Spectroscopic analysis is an exact science, and this is the manner by which the light is apportioned. And this places us in a quandary, because either Job knew that, or supernatural wisdom is being revealed here. Now that's just one more of the many examples of science in the Bible. And it's one more of the lessons that we teach here at the Mosaic Law School at Isabella, Missouri. Now, for more information, why don't you call and order our free General Law CD package first. That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. And remember, it's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining, and best of all, it's free. Now, you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Then just click onto the archives, and you can download that free General Law CD package right there off the Internet. That's georgegordon.org. All right, last time we were talking about this thing of uniformitarianism as it relates to spontaneous generation. Now, remember, it was Henry Morris that put together the 70 tests. I'm going to give you about 20. Well, I got 22 down here. We're going to take a look at about 20 or so of these tests. Now, remember, we took a look at the thing of the magnetic field. The magnetic field is deteriorating at the rate of 50% every 800 years. As far as we know, it's been doing that pretty regularly. If that magnetic field had gone back further than 10,000 years, the Earth would be like a magnetic star. The gravity would be so strong on the planet that life wouldn't be possible here. And that's our point. Because here under spontaneous generation, here's a quotation from a uniformitarian or an evolutionary textbook, and it says the Earth was born about 5 billion years ago, and scientists are not certain of just how that happened. But they believe that life began about 2 billion years ago in the shallow waters of some unknown seacoast. And let's pause right there. Let's take a look at that and see what scientific merit we can find. First of all, the Earth was born about 5 billion years ago. Why not 10 billion years ago or 1 billion years ago? Who said that it was 5? That's just pure speculation. Somebody just reached up and pulled the number right out of thin air. Boys and girls, that's not science. That isn't something that you can duplicate, replicate, that you can see, hear, taste, touch, or smell. That's pure philosophy. Scientists are not certain as just how it happened, but they believe that life began about 2 billion years ago in the shallow waters of some unknown seacoast. Why does it have to be a seacoast? Why can't it be out in the middle of the sea? Why does it have to be shallow water? Why can't it be deep water? And what makes them think that it was 2 billion years ago? Why not 100 million years ago, 200 million years ago, 2 billion years ago, 5 billion years ago, or 10 billion years ago? These numbers are just speculation. The entire concept is just a dream. I just dreamed it up. So I'm going to give you the George Gordon dream. I believe that about 6,000 years ago, God the Creator created the heavens and the earth, and that all of the life forms were directly designed by Him. Hell, my theory is as good as anybody else's. Now, I don't care what you want to believe, but these guys call this science. Now, I've already showed you as we were progressing along that I've got science in the scripture. The statement that says, in the beginning God created the heavens and earth, that's a scientific statement. Because of the laws of thermodynamics, we know there's been no past eternity of matter. Matter came into existence at some point in time. The uniformitarians come along and say, oh no, that's not true. In spite of the law of thermodynamics, we believe that the entire universe is composed of mass and matter that was compressed into the size of a dot at the end of this period, or a period at the end of this sentence, and that everything that we see out there is the results of that gigantic explosion. There isn't anything scientific about that belief. It's the exact antithesis of science. Science is knowledge, and knowledge is something that we can take in to the laboratory and we can test it, weigh it, smell it, feel it, measure it, observe it. There isn't anything here that we can weigh, taste, touch, smell, or observe. Now, a group of atoms, now this is their belief now, listen to this, a group of atoms came together in a very certain way. Let me ask you this. If I said to you, a group of automobile parts came together and assembled themselves into this automobile that we're driving, what would you think of that? Huh? Now, if I said, a group of mechanics took a bunch of auto parts and put them together, and the automobile we're riding in is the results of their design and their intelligence, that would make sense. That's scientific. That we can test. That's something that we can see and observe, and we can duplicate. But a group of atoms that came together in a very certain way. Well, what is this very certain way that atoms come together? If it happened once, it has to happen over and over and over again, doesn't it? Oh, you say it only happened once? It was just one of those curious bits of caprice. They formed a new type of molecule, a giant molecule, much bigger than all the other atom groups nearby. How do they know that there were any atom groups next by, what they were composed of, or that the atom groups next by or very close by were not bigger than this one that put themselves together? I mean, you see how this whole thing is just speculation. It's just a story. And it's a good story, and I'm not arguing with their story. I'm just pointing out that this doesn't have anything to do with science. It's a fairy tale, once upon a time, in a far, far land. This large molecule could do something that no other molecule could do. It was able to take simple atoms and smaller molecules from the sea and make a new giant molecule just like itself. The left front wheel on my GMC Suburban took simple atoms and smaller molecules from the sea, and they made a new giant diesel truck called a Peterbilt, just like itself. I mean, come on. if that's what you want to believe, get after it. But it doesn't have anything to do with science. Now, we ought to dare to prove all things. In 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 21, even God himself says, hey, listen, you shouldn't believe everything that everybody tells you. You need to prove it. Note from the above statement, science are not certain, but they believe a very certain way. They formed a new type. Molecule could do something. This molecule evidently has some kind of innate intelligence. Now, if you want to call the creator or the designer a molecule, I guess that's fine. Some people call him Allah. Some people call him God. Some call him Jesus. Some call him Buddha. You know, that's okay. And if you want to call him, well, you know, the molecule did this. I don't ever recall anybody calling God a molecule before, but, you know, I guess if you want to name him the molecule did this, that would make some sense. There's some intelligence there, like a group of mechanics and putting an automobile together from the parts. Now that I could follow. Now let's take a look at medieval science. In the Middle Ages, virtually everybody in Europe believed that rats and flies came from garbage. After all, every town had a garbage dump on the outskirts, and rats and flies were always seen emerging from the garbage dump. So it was an observed scientific fact that rats and flies come from garbage. Now, that makes some sense. There actually were people that could make observations, and they went out to the garbage dump, and they said, now look, around the edge of the garbage dump is just full of rats and flies. And when we go over here in the field, there's no rats and flies. Therefore, rats and flies don't come from open fields, but they come from garbage dumps. Now, that was the science of the Middle Ages. Now, that's about where we have uniformitarianism today. That's the kind of science that we're talking about here with evolution. That's just preposterous poppycock. Now, when we look into it, finally, an inquisitive researcher named Francesco Redi decided to test the accepted theory. In 1668, he isolated some garbage and just watched. And what do you suppose happened? Well, you guessed it. Nothing happened. Well, by the mid-1800s, the famous scientist Louis Pasteur confirmed this reality that seems so obvious to us today. So what's the conclusion? Imagine rats and flies can only come from parent rats and flies. A new scientific law was discovered, and it's called the law of biogenesis. Biogenesis. Now, here's what we observe. Uniformitarianism tells us that rats came from some other form. And looking at the tree of life over here, down at the bottom, we got a trilobite, and then a little bit further up, and then we've got a fish, and then we got a frog, and then we got a salamander, and a bird, and then a horse, and a raccoon, and a monkey, and then a man. Over here on another branch, we've got something that looks like a palm tree, and then we got a something, and then we got something else, and then we got some more, and then pretty soon we get a crawdad, and then pretty soon we get a cricket, and then pretty soon we get a dragonfly, and you know, on up the line. Listen, here's what we observe. Dragonflies only come from dragonflies. There has never been any observable evolution going on anywhere at any time for any cause or reason. Now, I know that people believe it, and I know that people write books about it, and I know you've read lots of books about it, but here again, I want to tell you, this is where it's at. It's called the law of biogenesis, and kind reproduces after kind, which is a scientific statement that comes from the Bible. That's science. That's what we can observe. We do observe horses being born from horses. And we do observe that humans are born from humans and monkeys from monkeys and so on. Now, if you wanted to test this, you could take some human semen and stick it into an orangutan and see what happens. And the answer is, it won't work because the genetic structure is different. The chromosomes are different. Now, orangutans and some monkeys and some gorillas, they might be able to cross and reproduce. There are animals that can do that. For instance, we've got musk ox, buffalo, and cattle. And if the chromosomes are the same, you can actually crossbreed them. We're told not to do that in Leviticus 19:19, but what the hell, you know, just because God says don't do it doesn't mean we're not going to. So you can breed cattle to buffalo, and we call them beefalo now. And you can take sheep and cross them with goats, and you can call those geeps, and those are the same kind. You know, goats and sheep are about the same kind, and they'll crossbreed. They won't do it naturally, but under laboratory conditions, we can do it. Now, here's the point. Horses reproduce after the horse kind, and that includes zebras and mules and donkeys. And there's a kind there that we call horse kind. But horses don't breed with lions, and lions don't breed with tigers, and tigers don't breed with orangutans, and orangutans. And we don't observe any of these kinds mutating and producing a new species. I know. I've read about the tsetse flies and the fruit flies. And mutations don't produce anything better than themselves. It's always a degenerate, less able to survive, which violates the principle of the survival of the fittest. Now, that's where reality's at, and that's where we can make observations. And going on, bio means life, genesis means beginning, thus biogenesis means life beginning, and it has come to be known as one of the most universal laws of science. Life begins from life. It always works that way. And consequently, the theory of spontaneous generation was discarded. It was obsolete and scientifically unacceptable. Unacceptable, that is, until the modern scientific illusion of evolution came along. And evolution doesn't even have the garbage. Evolution requires that life come from raw elements of the sea and nothing more. Now, what does the Genesis record say? Well, God said, "Let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after their kind," and it was so. It comes from Genesis 1, verse 24. Life comes only from life and life of pre-existing kind. And God is the one supreme, powerful source of living creatures, and all of them were created to reproduce after their kind. That's a scientific statement. Here, listen to this. "Let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and creeping things and beasts of the earth after their kind," and it was so. That's scientific. That's what we can observe in the laboratory today. And we don't see any spontaneous generation going on today, and the concept that, well, it happened at some time in the past, is just that. It's a concept, it's a theory, it's a hypothesis. And it doesn't have any bearing on reality. None. Zero. Zilch. Now, Albert Einstein has been quoted as saying, "God Almighty does not throw dice." Is it any wonder why mathematicians can have serious doubts about evolution? The complex design of a single cell. When considering the subject of chance as it relates to evolution, consider one of the most complicated single things that we know about, and it's called a living cell. Now, a cell is so small, it's microscopic, and has 11,000 parts, 11,000 working parts in a thingy that's so small, you have to have a microscope to see it. Now, think of it. Each one of us came from one single fertilized cell in the nucleus of that little dot. The master computer of what scientists call DNA contained the genetic programming for every aspect of the yet undeveloped adult individual. Every organ, every nerve, every hair, every personality trait, and behavioral pattern, as well as hair and skin color, are all programmed in those incredibly tiny chromosomes. How tiny are these mini computers? Well, according to Ashley Montague in his book Human Heredity, the space occupied by all of this data is incredibly small. If you could gather the programmed genetic coding for every human being on Earth from his father's side alone, it would only take up the space of less than half the size of an aspirin tablet. as impressive as microchips are to this computer generation of ours. This microcircuitry is beyond the incredible, but somehow random chances had to be responsible if evolution is true. Now, it has been estimated that a single gene is between 4 and 50 millionths of an inch across. A half million genes will easily slide around in a hole made by an ordinary pinpoint. Now, we're talking about a computer program here. Listen to this story again. We have computers that have microchips, and they're getting smaller and smaller. Have you noticed that? Remember the first telephones that came out about 20 years ago? I mean, those were pretty good-sized phones. We got one now that you can lose in my shirt pocket. I mean, that thing is really tiny. And it can, you know, it just flips open, you know, to give it a little more length, you know, so you get a little closer to your mouth. But there's micro circuitry boards inside this little telephone over here. And they're really getting good. Now let's take a look here again. Remember that? What's the size of these mini computers that program human heredity? Now listen to this. The space occupied by all of this data is very small. If you could gather the programmed genetic coding for every human being on Earth, that's about 7 billion, and just take the male side, all of the computer programming, the heredity programming from every human being on planet Earth, it would be about the size of half of an aspirin. Half of an aspirin. Now, this God we're talking about over here. Now, this guy is a pretty good computer expert, wouldn't you say? This guy's been around for a while, and he's got this computer thing down to a pretty small size. About the size of a half of an aspirin, he can program the heredity of all of the males on planet Earth. If you had one the size of an aspirin, you could program everybody on the planet. Hey, we haven't quite got that far, have we? Now, appreciating God's amazing design of genes, within the nucleus of every cell, 23 pairs of chromosomes are intertwined like a wad of spaghetti in the nucleus. These are made of DNA, and DNA molecules contain all the thousands of genes which program living things to go on as they do. Genes mastermind the complexities of life in ways infinitely beyond man's understanding. Now, here in one cell, there are 23 pairs of chromosomes. This is humans now. 23 pairs. 23 and 23 is 46. And they're made up of DNA, and DNA molecules and contain all the thousands of genes which program living things. One cell contains 11,000 little thingies in there that all work together. And it's so small, you got to look at it through a microscope. Now, you talk about miniaturization now. That's getting right to it, isn't it? Now, what do these genes do? Well, they determine all the inherited traits like height and personality type, direct all growth processes like when and how baby teeth are pushed out by adult teeth, and program all structural details for every organ and system detail in the organism. Just take a look at your body. Open your hand up. Can you see your fingernails? Can you see the joints in your fingers? Turn your hand over. Can you see the palm of your hand? All of that required programming. Notice your fingers all separated, and they come together in your hand, and that's all together. There's a split between your fingers that had to be programmed in. The size of your fingers. Notice the little finger is smaller than your other fingers. Your thumb is shorter than your fingers. And your thumb is set in one particular location on your hand. All that had to be programmed in. And it was programmed into one single cell. And it had 11,000 parts to it. And it contains all of the sizes and shapes. And notice that your fingernails are made out of a different material than your fingers and your hand and your hair. Okay. Different material. It's kind of hard, you know. All right. That fingernail has to be programmed to do that. I mean, you don't have a fingernail, you know, that's half fingernail and half hair and Or, you know, maybe you've got your hair and you got fingernails growing off of the ends of your hair or something like that. You know, the, made out of protein, but it's constructed in such a way that it has totally different uses, doesn't it? Now, the real surprise. We now realize that each and every cell in your entire body contains all of the genetic coding for all the other cells of your body. Okay, now watch this. It's estimated that you've got about a trillion cells in your body, and every one of those cells in your body has the genetic code for every other cell in your body. That's a trillion of them. Hey, you talk about miniaturization now, and this thing just evolved. You know, it was a giant molecule that gathered in other atoms around it and just did this all by itself. That's like saying, you know, the Brooklyn Bridge just built itself. Just a lot of atoms got together and molecules, and just by the throwing of the dice over here, one day we woke up and there's the bridge across the river. Just the right place, too, and it just connects the right place. The bridge isn't half in the water and half on the land. It's just exactly spanning the water. Now think of that. And somehow, despite the vast sea of blueprints, a liver cell always knows its own job and it keeps it. A liver cell always remains a liver cell and it does not become a heart cell or any other kind of cell. Now, not long ago, the single living cell was called the simple cell, but we don't call it simple anymore. You see, the bulk of the cell body was thought to be a jelly-like mass of what was called protoplasm, which simply means living substance. Well, in 1963, Dr. George Palade of the Rockefeller Institute in New York, discovered there is more to it than meets the eye. What he found was an amazingly intricate system throughout the protoplasm. Now it's called the endoplasmic reticulum, R-E-T-I-C-U-L-U-M, reticulum, ER for short. This vast labyrinth of incredibly fine tubes and chains of minute bags totally permeates the entire cell body. The ER has been described as one of the most complicated and beautiful structures in the universe. Another long-held concept of modern science has now crumbled. The idea that the cell is simple has been refuted. The cell is extremely complex, and the idea that molecules just bang around haphazardly in the jelly-like protoplasm has been discarded because of new light on the subject. Now, scientists today tell us that the single cell is more complex than a large city. As in a city, so it is in the cell. Systems are working and jobs are being done by the thousands. But unlike cities, the cell functions perfectly with no breakdowns. The adult human may have as many as 60 trillion of these walled cities. Think of the details that are going on constantly. Structural design, energy generators, invasion guards, transport systems, food factories, protective barriers, waste disposal systems, and communication links within and outside of the cell city. All right, now how do you like that for complexity? And this just put itself together in a shallow ocean 2 billion years ago. Let me get to that again. Scientists are not certain of just how it happened, but they believe that life began about 2 billion years ago in the shallow waters of some unknown seacoast. And here's the way they think it was. A giant molecule, much bigger than all the other atom groups nearby. And this large molecule could do something that no other molecule could do. It was able to take... See, now it was able to take simple atoms and smaller molecules from the sea and make a new giant molecule just like itself. Huh? The left front wheel on my Suburban gathered a bunch of other wheels together and automobile parts and... put them all together so that there is now 2 Suburbans sitting in my driveway. You know, you have to laugh. This has to be a joke, isn't it? Surely these people aren't serious. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it's open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the archives page, and you'll find that free general law CD package there. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements, these recommendations that we give, don't mean that the authors or the publications that we're endorsing will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review, they may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans in their viewpoint, may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine, they're mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about uniformitarianism here. Uniformitarianism is a doctrine, a theory of the origins of everything that we see around us, from the stars in space, the galaxies, and what we see here on planet Earth, all the plants and animals, the land masses, oceans, and everything that's contained in them. And the theory says that everything that you're looking at today, you just extrapolate it backwards into time, and then that's where it all came from. Now, over the years, we have come to a little better understanding, but the better understanding that we come to, we hide it, throw it away, and we don't publish those findings. If it doesn't fit with our preconceived opinions and theories, then we don't admit it into our thinking. That's not science. That is politics, and politics has now taken over science. Science is a branch of human knowledge in which we actually test things. When you have an idea, for instance, that rats and flies come from garbage, you take some garbage and you stick it into a closed container, and you watch it, and if rats and flies come from it, then you'll prove your theory, and then you tell others about it, and then they take garbage, and they put it in a closed container, and they watch it, and pretty soon it generates flies and rats, and you can duplicate it in Spain, in England, and Canada, and the United States, and then you'll know that rats and flies come from garbage. Now, if on the other hand, we put the rats and garbage into a closed container and we don't get any rats or flies. Now, instead of throwing that data out and ignoring it, we should include that and say, gee, we go out to the garbage dump and we observe rats and flies all over the place. We go out into the open field, there's no rats and flies. Our conclusion is garbage generates rats and flies. But when we actually test it, we find out that rats and flies don't come from garbage. Now, we need to keep that piece of information in the pool to see if maybe there's some other explanation that we haven't thought of yet. But that's not what these evolutionists do. They take that information and throw it out because it doesn't fit with the current theory. Just like they took the giant skeleton out of the Museum of Natural History up in Chicago, and I don't know if they threw it away or not, but they took it off display because it doesn't fit with the theory of evolution. They found a European man. They dated him 13,000 years old, dug him up on the banks of the Columbia River. Listen, human beings aren't supposed to be here 13,000 years ago, and so they buried it. They gave it back to the Indians, and the Indians buried it, and they won't tell us where it's at. It wasn't an Indian skeleton, and it wasn't Oriental, it was European. Now, that tells us a little something. If the guy was there 13,000 years ago, now, that's preposterous. That goes back before the Garden of Eden. But, you know, an evolutionary thought. It was a piece of information that didn't fit with the theory, so they threw it out. We've been talking about that all week. This is not science. This is just propaganda. Nothing more, nothing less. If you want to believe propaganda, stick with the program you're on because you can't miss. You're in it right up to your eyeballs already. Now let's take a look at fossils over here. Scientists today tell us that single cells, the single cell, is more complex than a large city. So, if that's the case, then where do these fossils fit in? We dig up these fossils all the time, and they tell us, now this proves evolution. And I'm sitting here saying, well, okay, let's take a look at it. Fossils. Have fossil links been found? If evolution were true, links between kinds should be found plentifully. Paleontologists have been digging fossilized remains of animals out of the earth for years now, but what they have found to prove evolution. Darwin himself predicted that abundant fossilized links would be found showing transitions from one kind of creature to another. All right, let's think about that for a second. You go back here to this tree, and I'm looking here at a fish, frog, lizard, bird, horse, raccoon, monkey, and man. Now, if this is true, now when we dig around, we find fully formed fish fossils, fully formed frog fossils, fully formed lizard fossils, fully formed bird fossil, fully formed horse fossils, fully formed raccoon fossils, fully formed monkey fossils, and fully formed human fossils. What we don't find is the transition species that are moving from fish to frogs, and frogs to lizards, and lizards to birds, and birds to horses, and so on. And there should be more of them. More of them. Because remember, it takes millions of years to evolve from a fish to a frog. And in that period of time, there should be some 90% fish, 10% frog fossils. Then there should be some 80% fish and 20% frog fossils. There should be these combinations, these transitions. Not a one has been found. None. Now, right away, that's a piece of information that we ought to plug into our mental processes, because that tells us a part of the story. It tells us a part of the story that we don't want to hear, that the evolution doesn't work, didn't work that way, that isn't what's going on around us, and that isn't what we're looking at. And as a result of that, we should start changing our thinking to fit the evidence that we have. So let's take a look at one. Whales with legs. The evolution of whales has been quite a mystery that has evoked some rather imaginative scenarios. Supposedly, a land-dwelling mammal somehow gradually made it back to the sea, gave up his legs for a spout and a few other things, and in time, the sea monsters of all time just evolved. Now, one recent article from a popular science magazine reported the conclusion that one paleontologist has drawn from his recent find. According to Philip Gingrich, whales may have walked on four legs 50 million years ago. He found a skull and several teeth and came to the remarkable conclusion that they had belonged to an ancient walking whale. The article draws some interesting associations, as you'll see. Now, how did he know that the piece of skull and teeth had anything to do with a whale, let alone a walking whale? Now, let's pause for a moment and think about it. You're digging around in the ground. You don't find the whole fossil, and what you find is a bone with some teeth in it. They don't have the whole walking whale. They've got a piece of skull and with some teeth in it. And the guy says, well, I think this is a walking whale. No, I don't. I think it's a crawling dinosaur. It was at a period of time when the dinosaurs were growing short legs into long legs. See, I can come up with just as many fantasies as anybody else. What the hell's wrong with my fantasy? He says it's a walking whale, and I say that it's a crawling dinosaur. You ask me, well, what evidence do you have? None. I just dreamed it up. Just pulled it right out of the sky, just like that guy did. And what do I call it? I call it philosophy. That's exactly what it is. It doesn't have anything to do with science. I can't prove it. I can't duplicate it. I can't show it. I don't have a laboratory model of it. Then you can't reproduce it or test it. But that's what I believe. Oh, okay. But what I believe doesn't have anything to do with the truth. That's where reality is at. Just because I believe something doesn't make it true. One time, a guy, I think it was the FBI or somebody, was doing an investigation here on the law school. It might have been the Southern Poverty Law Conference or something like that. Anyway, they made up a report. One of my students got the report, and he said, hey, Gordon, you want to see what the government thinks about you? So I said, yeah, I'd like to see what they think about me. So I got the report and sent it in here. And they said that Gordon has a propensity for putting together voluminous amounts of written material in his courses. Voluminous amounts of written material in his courses. And they criticized me, and they said that I'm just papering these people, that I don't have anything to say. All I'm just doing is selling paper. And so nobody ever contacted me from this group. Nobody ever said, well, why do you do that? What's the purpose? So I'll just pass this on to you. In my tax school, there's 46 chapters, and it's a 3-inch binder, and it has more than 500 pages divided into 46 sections. Let's see how many that is. If you got 500 pages, and you divide that by 46, you get 10.86 pages per chapter. That's 11 pages per chapter, round numbers. I don't think that 11 pages of material is voluminous. There's 46 things that you need to know about it. And there's a subject matter called the income tax, and that covers Social Security and status. We call it status and tax school. 46 things you need to know. 11 pages for each one, on average, of these 46 things. I contend that I need to prove each and every one of these 46 elements. I come to you and I say, let me show you the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, and I'm going to demonstrate to you that you are a practicing communist. And so I have three or four pages here with the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, and I start off and I ask my students in the class, how many of you people in here are practicing communists? Nobody raises their hands, and they look at me like I'm stupid. And I say, okay, how many of you have ever heard of the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto? Everybody raises their hands. They've all heard of them. And I say, okay, well, let's take a look at number one. It calls for the abolition of all right to property. And have you ever heard that before? Yeah, they'll nod their heads. Yeah, okay. Let's try the second plank over here. It calls for a heavy progressive income tax. How many of you people participate in or pay a heavy progressive income tax? And everybody raises their hands. And I say, well, that's the second plank to the Communist Manifesto. And they kind of look at you with a blank stare. And I say, now, the fifth plank calls for a central bank. How many of you people here participate in central banking? And they all look at you kind of stupid. Well, how many of you people have Federal Reserve notes in your pocket? Paper money, checks, credit cards? Okay, these are mortgages, you know, and deeds of trust and things like this, stocks and bonds. And you know, everybody, yeah, we do that. Okay, that's the fifth plank to the Communist Manifesto. How many of you people go to public school or went to public school or have your children engaged in public school? And they'll all raise their hands, you know. How many of you have a Social Security number? Oh, they all raise their hands. Well, the Social Security number is the eighth plank, and the tenth plank is public school. You see where we're going with this? I mean, and I just go through all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, and we should do the same thing. Now, all of you people here are practicing public school, central banking, Social Security, and a heavy progressive income tax. That's 4 out of the 10 planks. So even if you didn't practice the other 6, you're a 40% practicing communist, aren't you? So, you know, maybe we don't have all practicing communists here in the United States, but we have a lot of 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 percenters. Now, in order for me to make that kind of a statement to you, don't I need some kind of documentation? Don't you think I ought to be able to come in here and say, look, let me explain to you what these 10 planks are, and then let's take a look at them and analyze them and see how many of us are actually practicing that. When did we get started practicing the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto? Well, hell, Marx didn't come up with the idea until 1848, so prior to 1848, we weren't doing it, were we? So it was sometime after 1848 that we got involved in it. When did we pick up this public school thing in the United States? Well, it was in 1838 in Massachusetts. That's when we started. Public school has been an idea that's been around for thousands and thousands of years. But we never really got after it hot and heavy in this country until around 1886 when we started in California. Then it spread like wildfire. Hell, by 1920, we had public schools everywhere, and the federal government got involved in 1937. So it's been a long, slow process over here, but by God, we sure got it now, haven't we? And so when I put the paperwork together, what I'm doing here is putting the proof to put right in front of your face. Now, here's what I'm telling you, and here's the evidence, and here's where I got it. That's what I do. That's science. That's reality. That's what we deal with here at the law school. And if we come up with an idea and somebody walks in, they say, well, that's not true, and let me show you why it isn't true, and they bring in evidence, and they can prove that our evidence, our beliefs are wrong, then we have to change our beliefs. That's just the bottom line. You know, hey, we were wrong about that. We made a mistake. And we've done a lot of that, you know, and when we find that we made a mistake, then we turn around and we say, well, let's see if we can't get this corrected. Here's the information that we've got. Here's the information that corrects our information. Now what are we left with? And then we change our pages. That's why we use 3-ring binders. That's so that when we have a mistake over here, it's easy to correct it. Now, how did he know that the piece of skull and teeth had anything to do with a whale, let alone a walking whale? Well, the clue. The sediment in which the skull was found had been either a seashore or a riverbank. Conclusion. The creature lived in or near the water. Clue. The teeth were almost identical with those from some known primitive whale fossils found on the west coast of India. Conclusion. The creature was probably a whale. Now watch carefully as the scientific conclusion to the article is drawn. It must have been heading in the direction of modern whales, but wasn't quite there. so its legs probably had not yet evolved into flippers. Most of all, though he, Gingrich, hopes to find leg bones belonging to the whale species, it's possible that we will find some, he says, but we will be lucky if we do. You draw your own conclusion about the logic of that. He doesn't have any leg bones. But he says, we'll really be lucky if we find leg bones. Well, God love you, Mr. Gingrich. If, in fact, you find some leg bones to go along with this, you got a little bit more of the puzzle. But if you don't, then what you've got here is long ago and far away, and nothing more. So here at the law school, for instance, you know, when we deal in law, we have to deal in concrete facts. You know, when you walk into court and you want to prove your case, you know, the court, the judge, the rules require, the burden is on you. Come in here and prove it. You say this guy owes you $10,000. Come in here and prove to us. Show us the contract. Show us that this guy signed up and he agreed to make these payments. That's the bottom line. All right, going on, the supposed evolution of birds. The remains of an ancient bird caught in flooded silt and preserved have been called Archaeopteryx. For years, it's been proposed as a link between reptiles and birds. Why would some believe this is to be a link when it is fully feathered and with a bone structure which can be defined as a true bird? As Dr. Duane Gish points out in Evolution, the fossils say no. The only reason some make a correlation between reptiles and Archaeopteryx is because of its clawed wingtips and a beak full of teeth. Dr. Gish brilliantly points out the truth about this fossil. Some living birds today have claws on their wingtips, yet they're 100% bird. Teeth in an ancient bird say nothing of its ancestral connection to lizards. Since 1984, bird fossil discoveries in Texas have been given ages by evolutionists, millions of years older than the dates assigned to Archaeopteryx, and these are fully modern birds. So how did these birds evolve? Well, some evolutionists believe that birds evolved their ability to fly from the trees down. Look at the 1980 Science Yearbook. According to a feature article there, paleontologists assumed that the bird's ancestors, which, by the way, have never been found, learned to climb trees to escape from predators and to seek insect food. Once the bird was in a tree, feathers and wings evolved as if by magic to aid in gliding from branch to branch. Others have different ideas. Like I said, once upon a time and long, long ago and far, far away. Now, according to some experts, the primitive grandmother of all birds ran along the ground chasing flying insects, which they nabbed with their teeth or their front legs. Longer feathers on the front legs then evolved to act as an insect net. And so the legs simply became wings. And then they used the wings to make flapping leaps after insects. As the report concludes, if Archaeopteryx did not fly, it was just on the verge of flying. Controversial investigations by British evolutionist Sir Frederick Hoyle now cast suspicion that Archaeopteryx was fraudulently fabricated by its discoverers in the mid-1800s, even though we have zero evidence for the evolution of birds. Some popularizers and museums today are saying that modern birds are really feathered dinosaurs, highly evolved, of course. Now, it couldn't be that these Archaeopteryx creatures were fully formed just exactly the way they were with a creator, and now they've become extinct. It would seem like to me that if I had a bat fossil, and then I had a bird fossil, I could theorize that the bird evolved from the bat. That they originally had skin wings, but then over time they developed feathers. You know, we'd come up with an idea. Why did they need to evolve feathers? Well, to keep warm. Maybe the bats were freezing to death because of the ice ages coming on. They need to evolve feathers to survive. Well, that's a fantasy. It's an idea that I just came up with sitting here at the desk. You know, hell, my idea is as good as anybody else's as to why birds evolved feathers. It was to keep warm, you know, because of the advancing ice sheets. Now, somebody's going to say, well, how come the bat didn't just fly down to Yucatan or someplace away from the ice sheet? Hell, I don't know. But that's the point. See, neither do evolutionists. They don't know. And that's what they should be sticking with. They should say, well, I don't know. Now, here in the school, when somebody asks me a question, which occurs quite often because I'm not the smartest or the sharpest marble in the drawer, they'll ask me a question. I say, I don't know. Let's look it up and let's see if somebody else knows and if somebody else has come up with the answer. In law, when we ask a question and we don't know, we look in the law book until we see, well, did the Supreme Court ever make a decision on that? Has the Congress ever made a law like that? And we look it up to find out. That's science. That's scientific. And then when I go into court and somebody says to me, well, how do you know this is true? It's true because the Supreme Court said so, and here was their ruling, and here's the case, and here's the date, time, and place, and here's the citation. Now, that's the science of jurisprudence. Now, when we're talking about the science of biogenesis, that's the same requirement. You know, we've got to have some evidence. Who saw that? Who did that? Who demonstrated that? Who dug that up? And then we can put that together and put all the evidence together, and we got a conclusion. Now, the conclusion that we see so far is that rats and flies don't come from garbage. They come from kind, and they reproduce after their own kind. Rats reproduce after rats. Flies reproduce after flies. And the association of garbage and rats and flies is that that's where rats and flies live, is in garbage. They eat it. They like buzzards and pigs and other carrion eaters and cleanup specialists are out here working in the garbage dumps to clean up the mess. You know, an animal dies in the woods and the buzzards come down and eat it. That's what they're there for. They're carrion eaters. But that doesn't mean that rats and flies are evolving out of the garbage. It appears that way. I don't deny it. Back in the Middle Ages, you know, people saw that and they said, well, that looks pretty damn scientific to me. But then some other guys came along and they tested that and then they wrote it down. And now today we've got their findings, and that's what I do. We test it, and we analyze it, and we think about it. Is that the way that works? Is it scientific? Does it come out? And the numbers that these guys are giving us in evolution, they don't come out. They violate the laws of thermodynamics. They violate the laws of biogenesis, and then they call themselves scientists. What the hell kind of nonsense is that? We have to stay within these laws. I mean, you know, when you can observe various laws like the law of gravity, you know, when you drop two balls, one 10-pound ball and a 5-pound ball, off of the same height, they both reach the ground at the same time. It would seem like the heavier ball should fall faster, but it doesn't. And we shouldn't ignore it. We should test it. Hey, I'm about out of time. I'm going to have to give you a reminder here that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. And for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody. And good night, friends.